Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, here on the Mark Steiner Show, and our continuing conversations with those who would become the next mayor of Baltimore. We're about to talk to Doreen McKesson, organizer, activist, educator, co-founder of the Protester Newsletter and Campaign Zero, and here in Baltimore, former special assistant to the Chief Human Capital Officer for Baltimore City Public Schools, and has been a nationwide activist in Black Lives Matter. Doreen, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here, Mark. I'm excited for the conversation.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. For email, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages, but do call if you can, 410-319-8888. So welcome, Doreen. Good to have you here in the studio. I guess the first question is, as many people always ask, is so why did you decide to run? You lived in Baltimore, you grew up here, lived on the west side, grew up in Catonsville, worked for the Baltimore City Schools, which we'll talk about in a bit, went off to take a job in Minnesota, Minneapolis, mm-hmm. right? Heard about what happened in Ferguson and drove down there and just jumped into the fray. But why did you come back here to run for mayor?
You know, so I'm born and raised in the city, grew up around Poplar Grove and Prestbury. My first work ever was here with Baltimore Safe in Town campaign. I was an organizer, youth organizer in 1999 when I was a teenager, and that was work I did all through high school. You know, I'm running for mayor because I believe in the promise and possibility of the city. I love this city, and I know its challenges as much as its joys. And I know that what the next mayor will need to do is put forth a plan and a strategy for how we actually make the city work for people. So the plan that I put forth is across 8 buckets, but focused on it's coming from 2 real lenses. One is, how do we make a strategy for the city? So what I've seen happen in Baltimore, especially over the 90s, is there's a program about everything that people tried their best work, but the outcomes didn't change. And part of that was that there was no strategy from the mayor's office saying, here's how we connect the resources. And then about scale, you know, I'm offering scale solutions because the problem's here at scale. So 40% of our adults are not functionally literate. You think about 70,000 people addicted to substances. You think about 25% of our pre-K students are chronically absent. Like, these are scaled problems, and we have to have scale solutions. We know that establishment politics here has not helped people. And if the familiar is what we choose, if the establishment is who we choose, we know what we're going to get, which is this. So a fresh face and fresh leadership for the city, an outsider to establishment politics, but an insider to the city.
So looking at that, I'm curious, when you gave the stats you just gave, and these are questions that I have asked heads of the school system and more over the last 23 years, which is, when you have a city where there may be up to 65,000 people, I don't know how many school children directly at the moment, who have been poisoned by lead, as Freddie Gray was poisoned by lead, as his sister was poisoned by lead, as the tens of thousands of our children have been, which really hurts. I mean, we have to admit and deal with the fact that it hurts their brain functions. It hurts their ability to do certain things.
And there's no cure.
And there's no cure.
Correct.
So, the question is then, what? How do you respond to that question? How do you respond? I mean, in a literal sense, that how do you respond to the fact that 25% of our children are absent from school, and that so many of our kids, as much as I hate these park tests, and think they need to be done away with, it's clear the indications that our children are not learning in many of the schools. So what does a mayor do? I mean, and what can a mayor do? How would you respond? I mean, in a literal, very serious sense.
Yeah. So when we think about the school system, I remember that today that there is no plan. It's not like a plan that's a bad plan. There's not like a plan we don't understand. There are no goals and metrics at the school system right now, and that's a real problem. When we think about lead paint, for instance, we need to invest really thoughtfully in special ed, and the school system actually has done that partly because of the court case, the consent decree. And we know that we need to service students who have learning disabilities. We need to service them in ways that reference or respectful of their disability. And we know that so many kids who are lead poisoned have learning deficiencies, and we need to make sure we have a robust special ed department and fund it adequately. And again, in Baltimore, that has worked out only because of the consent decree. Some other things that we need to do in the city is that there's no adult literacy strategy. So when we have 40% of adults that cannot read, most people go through GED programs. And the GED programs are actually enrolling a lot of people but graduating very little. Mm-hmm. So I'm calling for an adult high school or a diploma-granting institution in the city that can give diplomas to adults so they can get the skills and a diploma. And then we think about pre-K. What's fascinating about pre-K is that so much of it is a transportation issue. So we know that if the seats fill up in a neighborhood pre-K, that people are less inclined to take public transportation or to transport a child to a non-neighborhood, like a pre-K not in their neighborhood. And, you know, the mayor doesn't run buses right now. So when we think about rerouting transportation for people in communities, that's not something the mayor can do. But at some point, the mayor will need to have a much closer relationship with the MTA to be able to address some of those issues, because they're not easy when we don't have a seat at the table.
You know, and I wonder where the money for so many things come from. And you do not control, the mayor, that is, does not control transportation, as you just said. But well, there are creative ideas that might work in another way. I mean, I it might sound crazy, but I thought about the Montgomery bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott happened. All the black cab drivers in the city put their cabs to the service of the movement and then started getting paid by the money that was raised to pay them. Maybe there are alternative ways we have to think about getting our children places that we don't think. There are hundreds of people who drive hacks in this town.
Yep.
Right? Which is what the people's Uber.
The people's Uber. I like that. Yeah, you know, the school system is actually one of the largest users of taxis in the city, because so many of our homeless students and special needs students are actually taxied to school. When we think about pre-K, though, like, we could actually just reroute buses. We could do a look at the transportation plan and reroute buses in the city in a way that made sense for people. We also know that families are citizens that take over 45 minutes to commute to a job, that two things happen. One is that their productivity decreases and their happiness decreases. So we need to look at transportation in those ways. We know that the neighborhoods with the longest commutes actually have the highest unemployment because of the transportation issue. So we'll never adequately address so many of these deep-seated problems if transportation isn't a real focus. And that's why it's sad that the red line is off the table, is that we need an east-west connector, which would do some of that work. We also need to thoughtfully look at the bus routes in general so that we can reroute them, especially in neighborhoods like Santan Winchester with 33% vacant homes, that when we think about the unemployment rate and what it means to revitalize that community, transportation has to be a part of it.
So I'm going to come into this revitalization question. Folks, do join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jerry McKissen is in the house, running to become the next mayor of Baltimore, 410-319-8888. Many of you have called in talking about him. Now it's time to talk to him, 410-319-8888.
All good things, I hope.
A mixed bag, but a lot of good things.
A mixed bag.
Always, for anybody, right?
I appreciate it.
For anybody.
It. You know,
for anybody.
I get it.
410-319-8888 is the number to call to join in this conversation. And at talkatsteinershow.org, we did get an email in just now from Bill, actually from Chicago, who writes, please ask DeRay to weigh in on the value of high-quality public neighborhood schools and to speak about the frenzy to reduce education to a single metric, something the privileged do not do when it comes to their kids.
Yeah, so I believe in neighborhood schools. I believe in the community school model, which means that we bundle resources for the neighborhood in the school building. And Baltimore has some strong models of that. We're about to do the 21st Century Plan, where all of our school buildings will be revitalized, renovated, rehabbed. And there's going to be a unique opportunity for us to build community centers as a part of every school when we do that rebuilding process. You know, I believe in public education. I was a sixth grade math teacher in New York City, came back home, opened up an after school program here in the city, managed the way that we trained and supported a third of all the new teachers here, and then was the number two in human capital both here in Baltimore City Public Schools and in Minneapolis Public Schools. I've worked with public schools across the country and know that they are important for our kids, and this investment in public education is one of the most important investments that we'll make from the government. I also know that there need to be standards in classrooms and that there are great educators all across the city. We do need to measure learning. We can do that in many ways. So there are some portfolio models that are really strong and we've seen them work. There are some ways that we can use standardized testing to think about equity and to make sure that kids are meeting whatever the bar is that we set. And that we're holding teachers accountable, that we can help parents think about how to support their kids because they know what their kids' reading level is, for instance. And those things really matter. But we do need to have larger conversation about what does success look like. And it doesn't just mean a standardized test.
Do you think it's important that the mayor regain control of schools?
You know, I think that the accountability question is an important question. What we know to be true is that there are cities with mayoral control that are not performing well. There are cities with elected school boards that are not performing well. And we know that there are cities with appointed school boards that are not. So I don't think that the issue of mayoral control is actually a solution. I think that that is a way that people are bypassing talking about some of the harder work, about like what does it actually mean to have a plan at the school system. I think over time, the mayor will need to have a closer relationship with the schools. I think that a partially elected school board makes the most sense right now. But again, there are no goals, there are no metrics at the school system by grade, by subject, and there seems to be an administration that thinks that that's okay. And remember, the mayor does appoint currently the school board members. And what does it mean to appoint a set of people who have allowed for there to be no plan and a superintendent that has said that it's okay to have no plan?
One of the things that one of the other people running in this race has said, which I found fairly compelling, Carl Stokes, a city councilman, has said that at the reform we took here at Morgan, one of the things he said was that we have a school system that's 83% African American, majority of whom are poor children from poor communities, and there's not one working class black person on that school board. Is that an issue?
Yeah, the makeup of the school board always matters. What's been powerful about this school board is that there are strong people who are knowledgeable about education. So you think about some other school boards across the country where the board just doesn't know much about educational policy. So when people present to the board, our board has been actually really thoughtful about pushing and making sure that the right questions are being asked in public. Again, there is something about the accountability for the superintendent, though. So you think about this superintendent currently, there's no plan, there are no metrics. It's hard to rally around where you can plug in to help the school system when you don't even know where the school system's going. And the mayor can exert that pressure to say, here's going to be a plan at the city level for children, youth, and families, and here's how the school system fits into that.
I'm going to read this tweet that just came in at Mark Steiner, and join us here, 410-319-8888. I meant to say that first email was actually from Bill Ayers that I read. And Meg writes in, tweets in, what will he do to bring new life to Brooklyn? We don't have any basic stores here, no grocery store, coffee shop, etc.
Yeah, so I'm sensitive to revitalizing neighborhoods by neighborhoods. So part of that is a development strategy that is not just centered on the harbor, that we have to start developing in neighborhoods. Like I said before, what's powerful is that we will be bringing development projects to every single neighborhood in the city when we renovate every school building and we can bundle services there. We think about the vacant homes. It's also really powerful is that we know that in Baltimore, any neighborhood with over 4% vacant homes, people are not moving into those neighborhoods. Only neighborhoods with under 4%. There's only one neighborhood in the city that had under 4% vacant homes and people did not move in. And that's important because the proximity to and from 4% actually changes the way we think about developing the neighborhood. Is that if people are not moving to the neighborhood, it's going to be hard to attract businesses to move into the neighborhood. So having a neighborhood by neighborhood strategy about attracting new residents when we think about the vacancies in abandoned homes, that will also help us attract new businesses and small businesses.
So what is attracting new people into a place like Brooklyn or a place like any place in the West Side or East Side do for the people who live there already?
Yeah, so it increases the sense of community. You have more neighbors. What it means to be a part of something larger than yourself. People access more public space when there are more people around. And the quality of life goes up. So people feel safer when neighborhoods are bustling and people are walking outside. Like, we know that matters. People take advantage of public space and public parks in different ways. And we've seen that happen with, like, Patterson Park recently. That Patterson Park is a different place than it was 20 years ago, and that's really important. So I think that we can do that in neighborhoods across the city, but it will have to be a neighborhood by neighborhood strategy, looking at what are the strengths of that specific neighborhood and how do we attract big businesses like grocery stores and how do we support small businesses growing and sprouting in those neighborhoods.
I mean, there were things I remember when Apple and Oranges opened on the east side of town that the marches started, the March Funeral Home. And it was incredible. And then they opened the store that didn't sell cigarettes, it didn't sell sodas, it didn't sell a lottery. And another business owner was on the show saying, well, one of the problems that he said in 8 months it'll be closed. And it was. And I said, why will it be closed? And he said, it'll be closed because they don't sell sodas, because they don't sell what people need and want, what people come to for. Sell the healthy things, but if you don't sell this stuff, you can't survive as a business. I mean, so what does that say about those businesses and how do we get those businesses into the community? I mean, there are far too many people in this city that live in what we call food deserts, have no place to shop. They just have corner stores, and the corner stores aren't what they used to be. They're all separated by plastic from the people that live in the community. So how does that change?
Yeah, to the city's credit, the city is actually doing a lot with food deserts right now. So soon, SNAP or food stamps, as most people call them, will be extended. The time frame will be extended in the next couple of years from 10 days to 20 days. And also there will be incentives for liquor stores and corner stores to have fresh produce in order to be able to continue to use food stamps in their stores. So that will be an important marker. And they're also for senior citizens right now, they can use electronic or online grocery stores. The problem is the access to the internet. So there are a lot of solutions, but if you don't have access to the internet, you're not able to take advantage of them. And what does happen in so many communities across the city is that you can order online and then they'll deliver to the closest library, for instance. But if you don't have a library, then that's sort of hard. And if you don't have access to the internet, which is why I'm calling for public broadband or public Wi-Fi in the city so that we can close that tech gap, because that is actually a real solution to some of the food deserts in the immediate until we can actually revitalize neighborhoods and bring enough of a market to a neighborhood so a grocery store feels like they can come in.
I mean, I've asked every candidate coming in here, and folks, do join us, 410-319-8888. No matter who you're voting for, who you're leaning towards, maybe you're undecided, your chance to ask DeRay McKesson the questions you want to have him answer about his campaign, about why he wants to be mayor, what he will do if he becomes mayor, 410-319-8888 is the number. So call us here with your thoughts and ideas. We want to hear from you. And continue to tweet in at Mark Steiner and write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. But when you have, by 1960s standards, they say we have 25 or 30% of the people in Baltimore living in poverty. I think that's low.
You think the numbers are wrong?
The numbers are wrong.
Got it.
That they're higher.
Yes.
That you have at least 40%, close to 40% of the people in Baltimore who cannot afford their monthly payments for rent and everything else.
Yep.
Which means that you're living in poverty. It means that you're living on the edge. So what do you and everything we do, right? And we're debating the whole question of building Port Covington, a second city inside of Baltimore, and that $355 million TIF that many people are opposed to. But in all this development, where is the strategy that affects the majority of the people in the city who are struggling and affects the other part of the majority of the people in the city who are middle class African-American neighborhoods, whether Howard Park, Forest Park, or Northeast Baltimore? So, I mean, none of these strategies think about these neighborhoods. None of these strategies think about what puts people to work. So what does McKesson do as mayor that's different than all these others have done? Or have not done.
I wouldn't say none of them do, right? Focusing on transportation, for instance, really matters to people so they can get to work and that they are not laid off and that they don't feel like they need to move. So the transportation issue is actually a big issue that has real consequences on people's day-to-day lives. I was the first candidate to call for a $15 minimum wage at the state level. That will have a huge impact on making sure that people have money and that money is traveling in our economy. And the skill development is really important as well. So it is one thing to attract businesses to the city, but if there's not a skill base that can actually take advantage of them, then what's going to happen is that people are going to enter into careers where they can't actually access the career ladder. So attracting new businesses is important, as is making sure people have the skills to do those businesses. So reinvestment in training, you know, a lot of people have been talking about that. I've specifically been talking about reading as such a gateway skill. And again, what does it mean? We're in a city where 4 out of 10 adults cannot functionally read. That changes the way people think about and people understand what their options are in terms of the workforce. And we don't, there is no strategy around that. Or senior citizens, you think about people who have retired and don't necessarily have the skills right now for a new generation of jobs, and we can actually provide those skills. We can show people how to use the internet effectively. We can do coding and things like that for people across the city. I'm calling also for an intramural league at the city level. So when kids want to do things over the summer or anything like that, like there is a space for them to do that. And not just sports, but if you want to code or if you want to learn how to play checkers or chess or whatever it is, we can actually do that at the city level. So people can access those skills. You know, there are people all across the city with amazing resources who don't necessarily know how to plug into the communities that want to access those resources. And we can actually be that bridge for people and classrooms. We can do that work.
Let me open the phones here and I'll come back to the follow-up with what I just asked. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us as we talk with DeRay McKesson. And Celeste in West Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, welcome. Thank you, Eileen. How are you?
But you're welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. I was calling because I'm on the fence as far as who I will vote for And one of the problems that I see is I agree with, I live in West Baltimore. Let me start there.
Okay.
I live in West Baltimore, and there's a community, a store, and the community has been there for more than 20 years, servicing the community, has fresh produce, groceries, and really the only thing in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
They were robbed day before yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I moved into the neighborhood trying to be a help. Liquor store opened on the corner. Immediately, drug dealers came. Immediately, crime returned to the neighborhood. And so, as a small business owner myself, I would not want to be in the community. I really wouldn't. I really am looking to move out of the community because I have a college student. I have boys in private school.
Yeah.
And not saying I'm better than anyone else, but the problem is I have a 20-year-old that with guys coming up to his car showing him pills.
Yep. Yeah.
So I no longer want to be in the community. Do you understand my point?
Yep. And I'm with you about the liquor stores, right? Is that the city actually doesn't control the liquor board. So who determines where liquor stores are going in the city and who has licenses isn't anybody in Baltimore City. It's the state does that. So the mayor should manage the liquor board or the city should manage the liquor board.
But we can zone them out.
Yeah, we can zone them out, but you know that that's not the same thing. That in terms of who grants the permits, like is actually like you have a permit. And that is the nuts and bolts sort of nitty gritty about knowing neighborhoods. And we don't have that control and we should get that back immediately. So, Celeste, I agree with you about that, that we should be intentional about where we put liquor stores in neighborhoods. And the zoning is a much more long term solution. But the liquor board is an immediate thing that we can do. It doesn't make sense that we're the municipality of the state manages around liquor boards. Like, I agree with you. The second thing is when we talk about safety. So the safety of communities is not just predicated on the presence of police. It's much, much bigger than that. And when we think about this prevention work, the police don't necessarily prevent crime. Prevention work is much bigger than police. It's about strong schools, families, making sure people have jobs. The response to crime is much of the police work. But even then, you know, there's so many people in our neighborhoods who have mental health trauma, and we need to have mental health professionals that also respond to trauma in communities. If our response to trauma is always someone with a gun, that just breeds more trauma. And then when we think about solving crime, is that solving crime is primarily police work, but that requires the trust of community. And people don't trust the police when there's not accountability and integrity. So I'm calling for a host of reforms around that. You know, in Baltimore, when an officer is involved in a deadly shooting, the officer cannot be drug tested, for instance, and that just doesn't make sense. You know, our use of force policy doesn't prohibit chokeholds. For instance, that doesn't make sense to me. So there are hosts of things, specific and concrete things that I'm calling for with regard to that as well.
So, Celeste, I appreciate the call. And I think we have to take a very short break here and come right back. And we have several callers coming up. We'll get to those. Avon has written in on Facebook. We'll read his. And I do want to talk about, when we come back, this idea of police policy and more. We're going to get into that and come back to these phone calls. We're talking to Ray McKesson, who's running to become your next mayor. Stay with us. Back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, with DeRay McKesson, who's running to be the next mayor. Someone couldn't stay on the line but called in to say to me that Apples and Oranges was really overpriced, and that's why they closed. People in the community could not afford those prices. Interesting. Okay. And before we go to Jeff and Kadria and read this question on Facebook from Avon Bellamy, let me continue this question from last time. We had recently on this program, we talked about the No Boundaries Coalition's report, Overpoliced Yet Underserved. I don't know if you read that report yet.
I have seen it.
Okay. So one of the things that and people talk about policing, and one of the really clear things in that report is, I mean, the physical face that we see on videos is the face of police shooting or beating somebody on the street.
Yep.
Right? That has aroused the entire nation, or parts of the entire nation. But the reality of this report says that what people are saying is the absolute physical and personal disrespect and abuse that people in communities feel every day of the week from the police, which is a big part of why people do not trust the police. It's not always getting shot and killed. It's just the abuse.
The wear and tear.
Disrespect.
Yep.
That happens every day. So And I, you know, when the commission comes on here, I'm going to ask them that question too. How do you take that report, that reality of all these West Side communities saying this is the problem? This is where it begins. How do you tackle that? Because yes, that comes with fundamental issues of culture and spirit and the way this, and the way racism, how deep it is.
Yeah.
How do you address that?
So I agree with you. You know, this is the work that I've been intimately involved in the last 18 months, both here and all across the country. And the stories are sadly not unique, right? That people all across the country have experienced the trauma of police. The only thing that's different about it now is that we can record it and share it in ways that we couldn't before. So that's really, that is the only different thing. We know that the culture of policing is what's broken, and we have to change the culture. And that comes with clear systems of accountability. So in the platform I call for, you know, the DOJ is already doing a pattern and practice investigation of the police department. So I am the only candidate calling for that to include school police, for that to be expanded to also include internal affairs, because I think that the lessons that we'll learn from the DOJ's review is really powerful. The consent decree in Ferguson is a model. The consent decree in Cleveland, so I'm hopeful that they will push the Baltimore City Police Department and that will there will be some concrete things we can do. We need to change the use of force policy to explicitly call for the preservation of life, to ban chokeholds, to say that an officer, you know, in Baltimore, if an officer sees another officer using excessive force, there's no responsibility on the first officer to intervene. We can actually do those things. And in Baltimore, if an officer is being held internally responsible for something or accountable, they can make an alternate hearing board. And me and Commissioner Davis actually agree that that makes no sense. It doesn't make sense that an officer gets 10 days before they make a statement when they're charged with the crime. There's no other defendant in the criminal justice process that gets 10 days before they have to make a statement. So there are a host of specific things that I'm calling for that will change the culture of policing, because it'll make the culture, make the police department more accountable. The Civilian Review Board should have oversight power, should have subpoena power, should hear original testimony. Like, there are real concrete things that we can do to make the police department accountable.
So making them accountable, but how do you control it? And how do you change it? I mean, one of the things you have on your own website here, as you say, Baltimore spends four times as much on police than health, 12 times as much on police as Parks and Rec, 18 times as much on than we do on job development. So that means you have to get the money from someplace else. It has to come out of the police department, be put somewhere else if we're going to do it.
Yeah, but so it's not. This is not. I don't agree with you. This idea that it has to be an either or. I believe that accountability structures fundamentally change the culture of institutions. If you know that you before could put people in chokeholds and it wasn't against anybody's rule, and all of a sudden that's not okay. If you know that you'll be drug tested after you fire your weapon and kill someone, that changes the way that should change people's behavior. And we've seen that happen time and time again. We saw it in medicine. We saw it in education. That accountability changes the way people interact with systems. In terms of the funding, so I am clearly calling for 1%, an immediate 1% taking from the police department budget and reinvesting it in children and families around the prevention work. And then looking comprehensively at the whole budget, it does not make sense that we spend more on policing than anything else in the city when we know that the prevention work is about strong families, schools, and jobs, that we have to invest that money differently. I think it makes people feel better because there's this public notion that the police are what keeps people safe. And we know that safety is much more expansive than the police. If I ask you where you feel the most safe, it's not in a room full of police officers. It's a room where there's family, where there's food and shelter, where there's love. And that is what we need to start shifting to that the police might have a role to play, but they are not the only people that are part of the safety equation. And I know this work well. It's work that I've talked to President Obama about, Loretta Lynch, Attorney General, Vanita Gupta, head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division, and Bernie and Hillary.
So should we cut the police department budget by more than 1% and put that money into safe streets, put that money into community work, put that money into Parks and Rec, building gardens, working with our
children?
Yeah,
so we should immediately cut the 1%, but we should, you know, as much as I know the police department's overfunded, I want to know exactly where the money's going before I sit up here and say we should do a 30% cut in the police department budget. We should look at the police department budget holistically and think about how to make sure that the money that is allocated toward prevention is actually going to real prevention work. And we know that that is not necessarily police work. We also know we can't arrest our way out of crime. We tried it here. It didn't work. And we know that things like gun buyback programs just haven't worked in cities like Chicago. They also haven't worked here.
So we have a bunch of tweets and messages coming in. Let me turn this over to our listeners. We have a message coming in that asks, please ask your guest why he had a fundraiser in New York City.
Yep. So I am proud to know people all across the country who believe in my leadership and also understand that the city of Baltimore is a is a strong city that is a model for how other cities do work in urban America. So I lived in New York City, and, you know, the first part of fundraising is asking your friends to help you out with the campaign. So I'm proud that I have 5,000 unique donors, more than every other campaign combined. So I did that fundraiser in New York City. And remember, you know, it's funny that the press reported it as if they discovered this, right? They did some sleuth work. I put it on Facebook. This is actually me being transparent about I'm fundraising. You know, I am not independently wealthy. I need to raise money to run for mayor. And I'm reaching out to my networks and my friends first. So that is people in New York City. People in Maine have donated, where I went to college. People in California have donated. People in Boston, right? So people all across the country believe in my leadership and believe in the promise of Baltimore. And I am the first part of fundraising is reaching out to your friends. And I have friends across the country.
What about fundraising in Baltimore? How's that going?
Yeah, it's going well, too. You know, there are. So the reality is that if you look at the fundraising landscape, is that so much of the money that goes to campaigns is from developers. It's from big businesses and they're bundling money. Right. So somebody's giving $6,000. Their partner's giving $6,000. Every one of their businesses is giving $6,000, which is why people can raise $500,000 from 20 donors. And I've been really clear that that's not the way I'm going to do this. I'm not taking money from people who are doing business with the city that are going to expect something in return. I'm not taking money from big businesses and developers who expect me to do certain things. I'm taking money from regular people, which is why I'm proud to say I have 5,000 individual donors.
Let me go back to the phones. 410-319-8888. Liz in George Hill Park, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I've heard a couple different mayoral candidates talk about making changes to the LOBER, basically in Baltimore City, and I heard Mr. McKesson just referred to that. And I know that last year and this year, people have been working really hard to make changes, and it's been unsuccessful. So what do you plan to do in terms of making those changes in Baltimore? What power does the mayor have to make changes that the state, you know, can you override the changes to the state? How does that work on a local level?
Yeah, great question. So the LEOBOR, the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, is state law, as you know. And there's some provisions in that are actually not covered in the contract because they are explicitly stated in the state law. At the contract level, for instance, you know, January of 2015, after the death of Mike Brown, the city and the police union came together and signed an MOU, an addendum to the contract that said that officers cannot be drug tested, for instance. And that is within the power of the mayor to say that at the negotiating table, we are or are not going to agree to certain things. When we think about the use of force policy, like I said, that chokeholds, for instance, aren't banned, that there's no duty for an officer to intervene if there's a use of excessive force, that's stuff that we can actually do right now at the city level by amending the policies and the general orders of the police department, the use of force. The stuff that's a little more complicated that is state law is around the 10-day waiting period, provisions like that. And that will actually take a little more work. Interestingly, we're in a moment where the DOJ could come in and say that some of this has to change even in state law. So when I'm calling for the DOJ to expand the investigation to include internal affairs, for instance, a department that has no standards for people being a part of it. So it's not like you have to meet a bar to be in internal affairs. You know, anybody goes, which is a problem for the city. And also to include school police, which are not included in any review right now, that the DOJ could come in and say that these laws have to change as a part of the court order. We've actually seen that model happen most recently in Ferguson, which is some of the most aggressive consent decrees that we've seen have recently come out under the Obama administration and the DOJ Civil Rights Division. So there is some work that can happen even if state law doesn't change. And I believe that one of the biggest entrances to that will actually be the DOJ right now. We should continue pushing the state legislature, and the advocates that have been working on that work have been doing incredible work.
Liz, thanks for that call. Avon Bellamy wrote in on Facebook, where is the money coming from? What economic partners have you developed to accomplish your economic goals, or would you, I suppose? Who have you met with, talked with, former strategies with, et cetera?
Yeah, so great question. So like I said, 5,000 unique donors, more donors than any other person running, all of them combined. And a lot of them are $3, $1, $10. In terms of putting together the platform, you know, I am from Baltimore, born and raised here. So brought together policy experts that I've known for a while and some new ones. And also, you know, I think about small business owners that I consulted with before I put together the platform. Artists I'm the only mayoral candidate who has a platform about arts and culture. The only candidate who has a platform about public health. So I reached out to so many of the organizers in those communities and also the people leading the research around those those issues so that they could inform the platform so it could be strong on day one. And, you know, I'm the only candidate, too, who has said, here are my commitments about the first 100 days across all eight buckets so that you know that, you know, stormwater runoff is a real issue in the city, and people think that the bay is going to be swimmable by 2020, and that does not seem to be the case. And there's some interesting things we can do about stormwater runoff, and I know a lot about it now because I've worked with those advocates. I know that we can invest in recharge zones, for instance, and that, you know, I'm calling for with arts and culture that there's a 1% set aside right now in development projects to go to public arts, and I'm calling for that to be doubled to 2%. So it's a deep, broad-based set of policy knowledge that is informed by people who have been living in community.
410-319-8888 is the number. Theodore tweeted in, how will he attack mental health and how that affects the homeless situation in Baltimore?
So great question. So like I said, especially with the police, that there are people who have mental health trauma in our communities. And right now, when people call 911, they get someone with a gun. And if somebody is potentially about to commit suicide, for instance, somebody with a gun, you know, I was just talking to a citizen the other day that said they called somebody for a friend who was about to commit suicide and a police officer came, and that just exacerbated the trauma that they were experiencing. So an investment in mental health providers as a part of our strategy of dealing with trauma is important. Some of that can be also community schools. What happens when we bundle resources in communities? You know, Baltimore in so many ways, the neighborhoods were built around schools. Schools right. are everywhere in the city. And when we rebuild and revitalize every school building, we can be really clear about where those community programs can go. And also when we think about homelessness, you know, we know that 35% of the homeless people in the state of Maryland are here in our city. And the thing about homelessness is that we need to make sure that there's that homeless individuals get homes that are responsive to their needs. So that some people need group homes, some people need institutional settings, some people need inpatient treatment. So when we think about how to make sure people are housed, that it is about housing that's responsive to people's needs. So some of that is mental health, and some of that is people just need to get up. People need the resources to get back on their feet, right? Whether that's a voucher, whether that is they just got evicted and we need to do some real reform to rent court. You know, we need to make sure there's a 14-day waiting period and that there are resources so people can get legal representation for rent court, which isn't happening. So the homelessness conversation is really complex in that way. But what we know to be true is that people who are housed have better outcomes than people who are not. And that sounds really simple. But what people anecdotally believe is that we should service homeless people first, right? So if you have a drug addiction problem, that is what we should tackle first and then deal with housing later. And we actually know to be true that the housing question is the most important question. And then we service people later. And this is what it means about having housing that's responsive to the needs of people.
Let's go back to the phones, 410-319-8888. A lot of people calling in. Jeff, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. Good morning.
Great. My biggest thing, I'm an entrepreneur in the city, and a lot of things have gone on with me dealing with certain issues in the city. And what I am coming across is a lot of things that are happening here, not necessarily I will put it this way. The city is not, to me personally, is not gaining or is not doing things in a trustful manner. In other words, it's almost a communistic type of a thing that's going on. And to give you a small example, but to me it's kind of big, my outside activities just for my mental health to keep me insane or whatever, I'm an equestrian. And I deal with a lot of times with the ARABs or whatever the case may be and the gentlemen that had horses down in the city. And those horses were taken forcefully away from those people for no reason whatsoever. And it was fabricated the fact of the animals were in danger and it came down that all of that is a fallacy. And then after they proved that in court, that this was not supposedly have happened or whatever, that now they can't even get the animals back or the wagons back or whatever
right.
because of the fact that they claim that somebody came up with a bunch of money and bought all these things from the city, and then they're hitting the animals through different facilities out in Baltimore County, which I've run across them because of my relationship with people in different farms out in Baltimore County.
So do you have a question? So I'm sorry. What's the question?
My question is, why does the city fabricate charges against people to make their life difficult?
So I think, Jeff, you raise an important issue here. I mean, not just because ARABers are an old tradition in the city, but many people see them as part of the future of potential food distribution in communities as well. Yeah. So what about – this is a big issue for the men and women who do the work and for the people who support them.
Yeah, so so part of what I started by talking about is that there is just no plan and strategy at the city level. So if we know that access to food is a real problem, that we should think about using all of the resources at our disposal to address that. So the A-Rabbers, I think, are a part of that. I know, you know, my grandmother used to go down and get fresh produce, you know, from the – I remember being a kid and seeing I'd never seen a horse in real life before. I was like, whoa, they're so much bigger than I thought. You know, so that they're not only a part of the culture and they're part of my childhood memories, just like the Kinder Band is a part of my childhood memory. As much as they actually do help people get food in neighborhoods that like don't have access to fresh food. And if we are serious about a strategy about making sure people get access to food, I think the A-Rabbers can be a part of that strategy. And that's what it means to have leadership at City Hall that looks at both the culture and fabric of the city and also says, here are the available resources we have. We have people and horses. I will never forget seeing a horse in real life for the first time. It was like really powerful. And we need to make sure the horses are treated right, that like, it's important that animals are treated fairly in the city and that they're taken care of. But I think that they have brought food to communities that have not had them in so long.
410-319-8888. Jeff, thanks for that call. Let us know what's going on with that. We'd like to cover that ourselves. I think the A-Rabbers are an important piece of our world here. Kadri, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to speak to the problem of the liquor stores in our neighborhood. Now, this is all across the United States, as I've lived in three major cities. Our communities are dotted with these liquor stores, two and three to a block, and they're owned by either the Koreans or the Arabs or the Iranian people like that, okay? Number one issue, I have never seen a black business in any of those neighborhoods, in the Korean neighborhoods, the Chinese neighborhoods, or the Arab neighborhoods.
I don't know. Well, what? There are no Arab neighborhoods. I'm not sure what that means, but go ahead, finish.
Where people live, they're basically from the same place. Everybody has neighbors like that. Everyone has neighbors like that.
All right. So, what's the question for DeRay?
The problem is, isn't that part of the political system to keep those liquor stores in our neighborhood, which attract the wrong people and sell this horrible liquor to us, which we can't control? And the next thing is that somebody just now said, the man that just called in, the reason why all this is going on like that is because the same thing the American people did to the so-called Indians. They ran the buffalo over the cliffs by the thousands to break the back of the Indians to make them dependent on them.
Kadri, thanks for the call. Your thoughts, DeRay?
Yeah, so again, the liquor board should be controlled by the city of Baltimore so that we can be thoughtful about how licenses are distributed. Right now, it's controlled at the state level. That doesn't make sense. And when we think about supporting neighborhoods, it's important that we look at the resources that are already available and that we should have a focus on small businesses and making sure that minority and women-owned businesses get the resources they need. You know, if you want to open up a business right now, it's not very clear how you would do that process. You should be able to go online and file the paperwork. You should be able to go online and see the process. I think that we should have open houses about so many things in the city, like once a month. You know, if we said once a month on Tuesday, the first Tuesday of every month from, you know, 7 to 9, there'll be an open house about starting a small business. Just come and learn more information. That would actually be really powerful so people have access and can get the information. And that's what the city is not doing right now. And that's what I say about the concrete things we can do, but also about having a strategy so people can easily figure out how they plug in.
So one of the things that part of the sentiment that Kadri just talked about was this real divide and growing enmity in our communities for lots of very real reasons and complex reasons between the black community and Asian and Korean communities that do own some stores in poor black neighborhoods. So that is a subtext to a lot that people have a hard time addressing or are afraid to address. How do you address it?
Yep. So some of it is that people don't. So many people have not been raised to believe that they can be business owners. And that is the work about educating people and creating access so people can say, oh, I can actually do this. This doesn't, you know, I think a lot of people, I remember being a kid and thinking that I needed $1 million to ever open up a business or think about doing anything independently. I never, the thought of getting a loan is something that, like, I hadn't understood as even as a young adult. And definitely people in my family did not. So some of that is the work of educating people and creating pathways. And then we know that our city has been, was the birthplace of inequity for so many things, like housing, discrimination. And
1911.
Yep. And we think about houses for most people in the country are the biggest asset they have. So when you don't own a house, you actually have less buying power. And that's the work of closing the racial wealth gap. So some specific things I'm proposing is matched savings accounts for both birth cohorts.
What does that mean?
We have a birth cohort of about 9,000 kids in the city. About 9,000 kids are born each year in our city. And we know that people save more when they have savings accounts. So that is like really simple. And cities like San Francisco have done it where there are savings accounts open for every kid that are born. And then we work with private investors in the nonprofit sector to match funds so that they are born with savings accounts. Right, and the families save more money. They have more money to go to college and do things. So that some of that is that work. And then with the housing, you know, I already talked about the 4% vacant rate. But when we think about vouchers, for instance, there are about 10,000 people on the waiting list right now for public housing, and we could actually say that we're going to use the vouchers more and make people use those vouchers in the city that would have that money just redistributed back into the city economy. We can do that. And the latest study about the vouchers that came out, you know, because some people. Sort of push back on the vouchers. And what it shows actually is interesting is that families who move that have kids under 13, that the outcomes actually change for those kids. The education outcomes, the health outcomes actually get better. Over 13, that there's actually very little change. But the vouchers are powerful.
So let me go back to the phones. Benny wants to know, if you don't win this election, do you plan to stay in Baltimore?
I have no plans to move out of Baltimore. You know, I might travel or telecommute or do things like that. But I have no plans right now to move out of Baltimore. And I am looking forward to April 26th.
410-319-8888. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
What I would like to know, what does your guest plan on doing about the dirt bike riders? I've seen 300 of them approximately come down Pratt Street on a Saturday evening, zigging and zagging out of traffic. If you hit one of them and stay on the scene, you stand a chance of being beaten up and shot. In D.C., they're outlawed, dirt bikes. So what does your guest plan on doing about that? Thank you.
Another controversial issue in our community.
I think about dirt bikes just like I used to, just like I think about how the city used to respond to skateboarders, that the skateboarders used to be really targeted by the city, and in skateboarding in so many public places was outlawed or people get ticketed and fined. We agree that dirt bikes in the middle of traffic are really dangerous. We've also seen some models across the country where they have created, there's open space and there's space for dirt bikers to use their dirt bikes in ways that are safe for the dirt bikers, safe for the public. And I think that we should explore those. We know that having the crackdowns in the middle of the street, like we saw not too long ago with the police just arresting all of them, actually doesn't stop them either. And making it a criminal activity, I don't think is the answer. But thinking about like what does a dirt bike park look like, and that is not unique to this city, that people have done that in the city, that we could do for that.
One quick closing question here, then a closing thought from DeRay telling us how to get in touch with his campaign. Deirdre, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to find out, Catherine Pugh has indicated that she would bring back the Dollar House program. I'm calling to find out, will you also bring back that program if you're elected as mayor?
Yeah, so the Dollar House program. So the Dollar House program is a powerful program. It alone is not a solution. The Dollar House program has to be a part of a set of solutions, right? So the Dollar House program, mixed housing, inclusionary housing, like making sure that we have development projects, that there's housing for low income people and vouchers. All of those are important tools. So I do understand the Dollar House program as one tool. I also know that depending on the neighborhood, the tools we use change. And that is really important to understand. So people who proffer that the Dollar House program will solve the problem actually misunderstand the problem of vacant and abandoned homes. But I do know that the Dollar House program is one tool that can be used in certain circumstances.
So, DeRay, how do people get in touch with the campaign?
Yep. So you can go to DerayForMayor.com. So it's DerayForMayor.com. Or you can tweet me at DeRay. Look forward to talking to people. And you can email me at Deray@DerayForMayor.com. Again, it's the only platform that's focused on the concrete changes we can make to make the city better across all areas. So not just crime, safety, and education, but also public health, the environment, and arts and culture.
Jerry McKesson, thanks so much for spending the hour with us, and good luck on the campaign and to April 26th.
Thanks, Mark.
Good to have you in the studio. On the way to break here, I'm reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org, or at SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association's banner. Take a short break. We'll be back with sound bites. Don't go away.